Hey everyone, Tawny here. I am so excited to share that my husband and I launched a non-alcoholic beverage called Parentheses. It's technically two drinks, a before and an after. The before uses herbs that stimulate the senses, and the after uses herbs that calm the senses. Head to drinkparentheses.com and follow us at drinkparentheses. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Recovery Rocks. It's Tawny, joined by my fabulous BFF.
Lisa. What's up?
Hello, my love.
Hello. Hello.
How are you?
I'm well. Doing good here.
We are also joined by another Southern California friend, Miss Paulina Pinsky. Hello, my love.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. I really am.
We're excited to have you.
We're so happy.
I'm going to read a little bit of your bio and then just give listeners a bit of our backstory. And then we're going to hear about your recovery journey and how our recovery journeys intersect and, you know, all the things. So
let's do this.
Let's go off.
All right. So Paulina Pinsky is the co-author of The Teen Guide to Consent. It Doesn't Have to Be Awkward. Dealing with relationships, consent, and other hard to talk about stuff. This book was definitely something I needed when I was a teen. I also had no idea why a nonfiction was a thing. That really blew my mind. So if you're listening and you have a young adult that you need to have an awkward conversation with, it doesn't have to be awkward. Please check out Paulina's book. We'll put that in our show notes. She's also a person in recovery, and we're going to really dive into that today. She has a really popular Substack called Newly Sober, Substack is just a newsletter. And she's a writing coach. She's very obsessed with the artist's way, which I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit as well. And of course we'll talk about music. So Paulina, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really admire both of you so much. And I had so much fun with you at your book event in LA. That really was like the highlight of 2023 for me.
Oh,
yeah, it just kind of opened my world a little bit in a way that I couldn't have anticipated. Yeah. I mean, not only because of that spicy margarita mocktail, which was so good. Like, I had three because I'm alcoholic and I was like, this is delicious. One is not enough. But just to be in a room full of people who are just trying to figure out how to exist without numbing themselves out, you know?
Yes. And listeners, just a little backstory. Paulina was the fabulous, my fabulous co-host on my book tour when I went to LA. Lisa also joined in, and I gave Lisa the mic during the event. So, Lisa and
only
Paulina,
a little bit, only on one question.
It was a good question though. And something that I love about book events that I really try to lean in when I do events is like, I really want it to be a group conversation. I think we achieved that with the LA event of like, my book and your book, Lisa's book, it's not just about us. It's about, you know, it's about community. It's about how we need each other to stay on the recovery path. So I want my events to mimic that as well. And so I'm glad that it kind of opened up your world too, Paulina.
Definitely. I mean, I heard someone say the other day that they looked up the definition of happiness. Because I think we're a culture hyperfixated on being happy, but we don't necessarily know what that means or how to achieve it. And this person said they looked it up and the definition was twofold. It was good, essentially good luck and being a part of community. Mm-hmm. And I'm now in my second year of recovery and I'm trying to learn how to enjoy my life because I don't think I've really ever had the opportunity to do so. Not that I've had a joyless existence, but I've been achievement oriented my entire life. And who am I without some sort of specific goal that is like semi outlandish, you know, but I accomplish it because that's what I do, you know? And so I've been thinking about that a lot, and I think that, you know, I'm part of a 12, like I go to 12-step meetings, and so that's one way that I find recovery community. But also, I think what I admire about your work, Tawny, is that you're making it accessible to people who necessarily don't want to go to 12-step meetings. You know, like I'm someone who needs 12-step meetings. Like, left to my own devices, my brain gets loud, you know. But I think that there's so many different ways to be in recovery, and there isn't a monolithic path. And I think being at that event really opened that up for me in a way that I maybe necessarily hadn't really fully seen prior. So I want to thank
Yeah,
you for that.
I love hearing that, and thank you for saying that. And I think that's why, you know, Lisa and I work so well together is because Lisa, you know, I'll let Lisa speak for herself, but comes from the 12-step community as well. My path is more, you know, yoga, therapy, journaling, writing, like all the, I have so many things that, you know, we call it our sobriety toolbox. And just 12-step was not part of that for me. I did meet my husband in an AA meeting though, which I think is worth
And
noting.
I
Yeah.
Me
Me neither.
neither. I thought
I
I
thought I
did
did
three
three
times
times,
and not
not
once
once.
through
Through
those
those
three
three
people,
people,
the
the
one.
one.
I
I
got
got 13
13
step
step
a
a
couple
couple
times.
times.
That's what that was a
That's
joke.
what
It wasn't good. I'll
that
workshop.
was a joke. 13th stepping is definitely a thing, and Nick was afraid of 13th stepping me. Because it was my first AA meeting, but I was like 2 or 3 years sober. So he hears a woman share, it's my first meeting. And so he's like, he thinks I'm super green.
We
And
should
so
know
the
what
really,
13 stepping is.
I didn't know what it was, but he
No,
was,
we should define it
oh,
so
yeah,
the
go
so
ahead.
listeners understand. So 13 stepping is when someone, it frequently happens. There's an excellent podcast that came out last year called The 13th Step. If you're interested in that, it's an amazing story. But 13th stepping is when somebody, it's you know it, the way it's typically played out has been, you know, men who are in 12-step meetings, and there's a newcomer, generally a woman, that they sort of try to take under their wing and then hit on, you know, and it is very much against all AA principles, because in 12-step it is very much, you know, you stick with your same identified sex, and that is to specifically avoid this kind of predatory thing. And it's something, it's to be avoided. So, but if you want to understand, and it gets written about a lot and talked about a lot, because, you know, there's real harm done when it happens. My experience in almost 20 years of 12-step has been that I've never had. In fact, I've seen quite the opposite go on in the rooms I've been in, where people watch out for somebody going after someone new. But I know that's not always the case. So that's what 13-step is.
Oh, thank you for that. And it's, you know, I go into that in the book, in my book, because I talk about how I met my husband, and I also don't recommend that as a place to meet people. It's, you know, I talk a lot about trauma bonding in the book and how, you know, what Lisa just described is, you know, you meet someone in rehab, you meet someone in a 12-step meeting or any peer support group, any vulnerable place, it does make you vulnerable to trauma bonding. So, it's very like I feel like I always have to give that caveat when I'm like, I met my husband in an AA meeting, but don't do it. Do not
I get that you have to do that.
I was someone for so long who chronically entered a room was like, is that my husband? You know, and the last place you should
Same.
do that, yeah, is an AA meeting when you have under a year sober. And but that being said, I'm grateful to those experiences because now I'm with a partner who is sober but not in the rooms. And I needed to go through those sort of romantic entanglements to understand what I don't want in sobriety. Because when I was high and drunk, I could numb out and be like, this is fine, this is normal. But then when the weird, painful stuff happened, I was like, this is yucky. We don't do this again, you know? So I didn't go out, you know, like that's the fear of 13 stepping is someone comes into your life and kind of poaches on you and your sobriety becomes about them and then they disappear and then you go out, you know, and that wasn't the case. Like ever since I got sober, I was like, I don't think I have, I went too fast and too hard and now I'm retired, you know, like we're off this ride for life, you know?
That's very real. And also, I can also, real quick, I'm going to say one more thing and then I want to hear Paulina's story. But being a bisexual person who was also, I did some SLAA meetings, and like sex and love addiction has been a big part of my recovery story. So being a bisexual person in a SLAA meeting is hilariously sexy and not sexy, because I'm like, everyone here, like, we're just trauma dumping. It's so hot, and I have to get out.
Like my dad always says, you want butterflies, not lightning bolts. And in a SLAA meeting, you're sitting there, I'm sure it's lightning bolts all over the place. And you're like, I'm so turned
Mean,
on.
I'm showing Paulina my lightning bolt tattoo, so yeah, I'm very much into lightning
It
bolts.
a lightning
is your
bolt
thing.
tooth gem.
Oh.
So
Oh my God, how cool is that?
that was not a sober decision, but I stand by it.
I support that. Okay,
Amazing.
Paulina, can you tell us a little bit about your recovery story? And let's begin with the most important thing, that you got sober on my birthday.
I did get sober on your birthday, which is also my mom's birthday. So, you know, it's ironic about that. I'm a triplet, and so I now share both birthdays with two other people. So I don't know if that's like some karmic thing. I love to be the center of attention, and the universe was like, that's funny. Share
Yes.
this.
I mean, and you're a spicy Scorpio, so.
And so it's been a real karmic lesson. It's humbled me good. Well, so I'll wind it back. One of my first memories was going to I used to go on rounds with my dad. So my dad's Dr. Drew. He is not a psychologist or psychiatrist. He is an internist. And so when I was a kid, I would go on rounds with him at the hospital. And I remember like walking down the like hallways, holding his hand and like smelling antiseptic and talking to the old people. But he was also chief of medical staff at a rehab in Pasadena called Los Encinas. And when we went with him there, we were only allowed in the nurse's station. We couldn't wander around. But we always sat there and like scribbled out like on like prescription notepads with prescription pens, like whatever. They just had us doodle or whatever. And I remember this one time, this woman came in to the nurse's station holding a baby blanket and demanding more meds. And I believe she was a methadone addict. I have to ask my dad. I always forget. It's funny because he's told me so many times, but like my 8-year-old memory like cannot grasp the details. And so she was demanding for more medication. And when they didn't give it to her, she had a full-blown tantrum, like sucking her thumb, screaming on the nurse's station. And that was my first sort of like, oh, dad's telling us at the dinner table, when you do drugs, your brain stops developing. Drugs are bad. That was the first time that it clicked. I was like, oh, drugs are scary. Like my dad would never let me act like that. And so there was a very clear presence of drugs and alcohol. Don't use them. It impacts your brain development. You know, and then when I got older, it was like, if you go to a party and if there are adults serving minors, I will call the police and I will not bail you out of jail. Like those are like the messages I got growing up. And I, of course, was a perfectionistic, high achieving figure skater, going to a really intense K through 12 school. And so I had no reason to drink or use. My first sort of vice was like starvation. That was sort of the first way in which I felt control in control. And so around age 12, I like went to a nutritionist and like thus began like my 7-year experience with being active in an eating disorder. And so I came to the game kind of late. I didn't drink for the first time until I was like 18. But I was like at this like girl's house who was like a known partier, and I was like going shot for shot with her. It was like a Svedka bottle and like cranberry chaser. probably took down like 7 shots. And I remember kind of feeling wavy. And then in the middle of the night, I like projectile vomited. And like that was like my first time. So like I got the nickname Barfelina pretty quick.
Sorry to laugh. That's just a
No,
good
it's it is
it's
it's
a good
really funny.
Oh.
And so like when I first came into recovery, I was kind of in denial about like the drinking aspect of it, but I've never been a normal drinker ever. Like the only way I was able to like have one glass of whatever was because I was stoned, you know? And so I have to remember that like my first experiences were like either drinking to blackout or drinking to vomiting. And so through college, just drank my face off, you know, and experienced depression. But also in college is when I started addressing my eating disorder. So at like 19, I hit a bottom with bulimia where I like purged 8 times in one day. And I was like, that's like it broke through the denial. And I was like, I can't ignore this anymore, you know? And so that was sort of my first foray into recovery. I like put myself in therapy and like I was part of this group called Endangered Bodies in New York City, which was a feminist discussion group about sort of like female portrayal in the media and body image. And it was like 2012, and so like body positivity was huge. And body positivity is a huge part of my story. If only like I never found it to be sort of like a toxic expectation. Like I found it to be very hopeful that like I wouldn't look in a mirror and hate myself every day, you know? And like I remember walking around college and like comparing my body to every body I pass. I'm like, oh, I'm bigger, I'm smaller. And like I think, yeah, it's just such a mind fuck. And so in eating disorder recovery, that's when I started writing. And something that's really interesting to me is I used to be a huge journaler growing up. I would like write a list of who I had a crush on, like the rotating list every day, you know, from like ages like 7 to 12. But when my eating disorder started, I stopped writing. But then when I came into recovery, that's when I started writing again. And so I wrote a piece in my college newspaper called Get Your Teeth Checked about my eating disorder recovery, what I told, like telling my mom that I was bulimic. The hook of the essay was Get Your Teeth Checked. That's what she told me when I told her I was bulimic, which is a great hook.
It's a good. Can you explain a little bit
It is.
about why? Because some people may not understand
Yeah,
the
so
connection there.
essentially like the narrative is that I was in a car with my mom and I was telling her that I was bulimic and she told me to get my teeth checked. And at the time, it was such a painful reaction because it was like I wanted the sort of like nurturing like I'm so sorry and we love you, and instead I got this very like sort of pragmatic cold like get your teeth checked, which in retrospect makes sense because when you're actively bulimic your teeth can corrode from that. And so my grandmother actually lost all her teeth at 20 to gum disease, and my mom like has all veneers, and so like her sort of like very pragmatic cold response makes sense in the lineage of like, yeah, in my family. And so it was just kind of a painful thing that I could like I for me, writing is healing. Like I was carrying that until I put it down, you know, and through putting it down, I was healing. But I also, you know, it was my first personal essay, and so it ended in this like, and now we're going to heal intergenerational body trauma and we're doing great, you know? Meanwhile, like, I can't sit in a room with my mother without screaming at her, you know? Like, it was like it rudimentary intro writer, like, I'm going to put a bow on this and it'll be great. And so 6 months later, it got picked up by the New York Post by virtue of who my father is and went national. And so I was like on The View and Entertainment Tonight and Extra and like CNN. And I'm 21 years old being like, my family is perfect. Like we don't feel pain. But essentially, like that experience drove me into my substance abuse so much more because this thing that was actually my biggest secret was now national news. And I'm a, you know, competitive figure skater growing up, so I'm hyper performative. And so these people like in college are like, "You're so brave." And I'm like, "I just want to get drunk. Like, I'm not brave, you know?" And so college, I was like drinking to blackout like 4 nights a week. Like, I have no idea how I graduated. I don't, I mean, I like there's I just applied to a program and I was looking at my GPA and I was like, people notice the 2.7 is noticeable at, for all of your sophomore year, you know?
Yeah, it drops the average down a little bit.
Like, it's so funny how while it's happening, you're like, no one notices, everything's fine. And you look back and I'm like, clearly something was happening here, you know? But depression is also a huge part of my story. And especially after that experience, like, I just felt incredibly alienated. I was like, how do I articulate sort of being sensationalized like this? And also, like, what I wasn't being true to myself, you know? Like, I was just kind of like putting on the PR face. And so after college, moved to Chicago, did improv and a sketch comedy at Second City. And then came back to New York for my MFA in nonfiction creative writing. And when I started my MFA, I started experiencing debilitating migraines. And so I couldn't drink anymore. And so that's when marijuana came into the picture. I was dating someone who had been identified as a marijuana addict, had dropped out of school because of marijuana, but introduced me to marijuana and was like, don't tell my parents. This is, you know, this is chill. I got it. And just like immediately like was smoking every day. And so for me, it started out as quote unquote medicinal, but I look back and it just kind of like it never cured my pain, but it kind of reconceptualized the pain. And the other thing about marijuana is that I could eat with reckless abandon. Like, I, you know, obviously had eating disorder history, and so when I smoked, it was like I could eat without the chatter in my head. And so when it first came into my life, I was like, this is amazing. You know, like, not only do I not feel as hungover, but my migraines feel different and I can eat whatever I want. But you know, in the rooms they always say, like, you know, it's magic, medicine, misery. And it was fun for a couple years, but it accelerated. You know, my tolerance grew and I was isolating more. And by the time the pandemic hit, which I was in New York for that, so I got my MFA, still smoking. And once I started smoking weed, it was just kind of like, I'll try anything, you know? Like, I became the garbage can, the walking garbage can. I'm like, yeah, I'll try that. I trust you implicitly, and if you're gonna put that in your body, I'll put it in my body. You know, it's like there was no sense of like safety, self-awareness, anything. And so I got my MFA June of 2019, and that summer I was just like, Adderall, whatever, you acid, whatever, you know, like I was just like it was like peak addict behavior, which was, but it was still fun. Like, during that time, I got a Tinder match that was like, hey, do you want, I know this sounds crazy, but do you want to come up to Vermont with me and my childhood friends for the 4th of July? You know, and like now, like I would have been like, I'm sorry, who are you? You know, but I was like, let's meet first, you know? And then I went up for the 4th of July and I was just like the stranger in the house. And like, I kind of thrive in that situation. Like, I love being like the one that nobody knows, and I can just like turn on that, like, I'm the most fun girl in the world, you know? And just like did DMT, shrooms. Like, it was just like a drug fueled weekend. The guy ignored me the whole time, unless we were dry humping in the bedroom we were sharing. Like, it was,
Oh, there it is.
yeah.
She said the word ding, ding, ding. Dry
Ding, ding,
humping.
ding.
Big
There's
fan
a
of dry
prize you
humping.
get at the end of the episode for that.
Amazing. And so then I met my ex. He introduced me to psychedelics, and then I started writing It Doesn't Have to Be Awkward, which I called the consent book I didn't consent to for a really long time.
Oh shit. That's a whole other episode.
Yeah, there's so many episodes in this in your story.
I know. It's so hard because it's like none of it, they're all tied. I know, it's a whole explosion. And so I'm like writing this book that I feel resentful about. But essentially, like my dad came, I was like selling t-shirts at my dad's podcasting event because my mom was like, what are you doing the 17th? I was like, are you guys in town? You want to hang out? And she was like, I need you to sell t-shirts at dad's podcasting event. And so I'm like selling t-shirts, and my dad's like, we sold the book today. I was like, what book? He's like, the consent book. And I was like, he's like, we talked about it. So like essentially I got handed a book deal, which at the time, like, I was like, I'm literary nonfiction, like commercial YA, you know, like so pompous. Now I feel so much gratitude because that book essentially saved my life, you know, like,
So this is for listeners, this book that Paulina's talking about, she wrote it with her dad. So yeah, that's yeah, just wanted to make that clear.
it's co-written with my dad. And I was so resentful throughout that experience. And so my drug addiction accelerated. It was like, okay, I'm gonna be stoned while I write it. You know, that isn't to say that it isn't valuable information. That, again, that book saved my life.
It's a great book.
Yeah, I mean, it's great for anybody
It's
who wants to check it out for sure.
The COVID totally accelerated my addiction. At that point, we're doing like dabs and like I'm stoned all the time. And
And
essentially,
so, real quick, dabs, is that like that's a very concentrated dose of THC,
it's like
right?
marijuana to a methy degree, essentially.
To a methy degree. I like that. Okay.
And so you have to essentially use a torch, a flame torch, to heat up a glass cup, and then you put the wax in and put a cap on it, and a ball spins as you inhale. And the first time I did a dab, I felt my soul leave my body, and then I projectile vomited onto the couch and the dog, and then shook in a bathtub for 4 hours. And that was like just the first time I did it. And
So
so,
Barfina returned.
oh yeah. And that's
Return
my,
of Barfina.
yeah.
That's your next book.
Yeah.
That's my addiction memoir, it's just Barfalina. And so at this point, the boyfriend had moved in the week before COVID. I was in New York during COVID. It was, you know, I won't go into it, but essentially forever his addiction was bigger than mine. And so I could, you know, I'm doing the laundry and walking his dog, and like he's doing before, during, and after work, and doing ketamine and Vyvanse and like just a whole bunch of stuff. And so both of our addictions were accelerating, but his was worse. So I was able to be like, I'm helping you. You need help. But essentially, fast forwarding to rock bottom, we were going to New Orleans. We're driving from New York to New Orleans to go to his home for Christmas. And we had run out of weed, and we were like, let's do a sober Christmas. I think a huge part of my story is weed-induced psychosis, and withdrawing from THC can also start weed-induced psychosis. And so my ex was in weed-induced psychosis for the duration of the 3-day drive. And the reason I say the book saved my life is because a big hyperfixation for him was he's an antinatalist. And so he believes people shouldn't have children and that we should walk into extinction hand in hand. And so he's screaming at me and I'm driving, and all of a sudden he calms down and he's like, if you're going to have a panic attack, you need to pull over. And it was almost like I saw, 'cause a huge tenet of the book is TCB, trust, compassion, and boundaries, which is lifted from Elvis, which is like his sort of emblem is TCB with the lightning bolt. And I've been an Elvis fan since I was like 8, and I wore that necklace for like 10 years, and it was my first tattoo. And so we co-opted that acronym, and made it trust, compassion, and boundaries. If you trust yourself, you can trust someone else. If you have compassion for yourself, you can have compassion for someone else. And if you know your own boundaries, you can respect someone else's boundaries. And it was almost like I saw the TCB like in like sort of big cartoon letters, and all of a sudden like the T shattered, and I was like, he is not being compassionate to me, and I've asked him to stop yelling at me multiple times. Like, it was only because I had been promoting that book and talking about TCB so much that, like, don't have all three elements, your relationship is dead in the water. And so that's why I say, yeah, that book saved my life, because I had to write it and talk about it so much in order to break through my own denial, both in my relationship and in my addiction. And so, for me, I had a panic attack in an Alabama gas station. That was my come to Jesus moment. Like, I had to witness someone else's disease accelerate to a crazy degree in order to see it myself. flew home on the 20th, had my last glass of Chablis at my mom's birthday dinner, and then the 22nd was my first true day of sobriety. So that's the whole long story. I'm sorry. It's so long.
I'm sorry for my story.
No, it's fascinating. I think it's really, you know, it's amazing what you have done and what you have come through. But also, I mean, I think these are such important things to, you know, you really illustrate how like one thing can build on the next, can build on the next, right? And, you know, that idea of like feeling like you had to be perfect all the time as a figure skater. And then, you know, when being sort of then with the eating disorder, then being forced to be like a poster child for recovery from eating disorder, something like, you know, it's like, again, you had to put on a face and, you know, time to, you know, figure out how we can get out of that. And that's where the drugs and alcohol came in. You know, it's really the way everything kind of built on what had gone on before, I think, is sometimes we can lose sight of that in our stories.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think so much of my story is interconnected, that like it's not just pure alcoholism or addiction or whatever, like whatever that thing in me is, like to sort of numb out or eclipse reality or whatever, or be better, has always lived in me and has mutated into different forms, whether it was like, I need to be 100 pounds, I need to, you know, it's like, it's all kind of the same thing, which is why, you know, I go into all of it, is because it's not just one thing.
And I very much appreciate that, because, you know, that's something that Lisa and I really model this podcast after, is that, you know, that's why we say recovery. You know, it's not just sobriety, like it's not just alcohol, you know, it's like eating disorders, like all drugs, all, it's really, it's mental health recovery, right?
So perfectionism, workaholism, like
all of it,
that. Yeah,
all of it, gambling, sex and love addiction. And something that I think is interesting about your story is that, you know, we're in this time right now where people are drinking less alcohol. People are just more curious, more interested about alcohol-free life. Mm-hmm. And I'm very aware that this is happening while cannabis is becoming legalized and destigmatized. So, you know, I think it's too new. There's no studies on this yet. And it's going to be difficult to study that because it's all self-reported use, right? But I have a theory that a lot of people are probably doing more, just I've interviewed people and they're like, oh yeah, I don't drink anymore, I'll just take a gummy before a concert, you know, something like that. So I bring all that up because I think it's important to talk about the dangers of cannabis becoming legalized too. You know, Lisa and I, we did an episode about a year ago where I quote unquote came out as someone who uses cannabis in recovery. And, you know, that was a really big moment for me. I called Lisa the day that the episode went live. And I was like, I feel so naked. I feel so vulnerable. Like, I've literally been almost naked on the internet, and I feel more vulnerable now that people in recovery know that I use cannabis. Like, it was just really scary. And it's been something that I'm working through. And then, it, you know, before I asked you to join me in LA for the book event, I was like, I just want to be transparent with you. I use cannabis in my recovery, and I know that cannabis was a big part of your addiction. So I really wanted you to know who you were, you know, getting into bed with before, because consent is super important to me. And if you didn't feel comfortable aligning yourself with someone who uses cannabis, I wanted you to have that ability to advocate for yourself, you know. And and if you're listening and you have no idea that this is part of my story, we can link to that original episode where I talk about finding a cannabis doctor.
That speech with like the little cross, you know.
Yes, an actual cannabis doctor who is a professor of cannabis at NYU. She is a legit doctor. And then finding a cannabis inclusive therapist, who, you know, like I'm very mindfully introducing this into my recovery. So I don't want to spend too much time on that, but I did want to say that, you know, your story, I really think just speaks to the fact that there is no one way to recover. Mm-hmm. And one person's recovery might look very different from someone else's, and that's okay.
Definitely. No, and I appreciate that, one, your transparency with me, and two, that you're talking about it, because what I feel is problematic is when people call it medicine, but then are doing dabs. You know, like, I think the rhetoric, I don't have problem with, like, my issue, I'm never going to take a stance on legalization or decriminalization. Like, that's just, it's going to happen how it's going to shake out. But I think so much of the rhetoric used to legalize is backfiring because it's putting words in people's mouth as they are actively addicted to it. And what I appreciate about you is that you are actually using it medicinally. That, like, to use it medicinally is to use CBD with a slight bit of THC so that the CBD is act, you know, like, there are ways that are, it is actively medicinal. And I think you're maybe the only person I know who I've spoken to who's actually using it medicinally. And so, again, this isn't a judgment, but I think, again, like, there's so much rhetoric around marijuana that people are just regurgitating without thinking. That's just justifying mm-hmm. copious use that is actively destructive. Because what's scary about marijuana addiction is that it's the delusion of a functionality, where, like, I would be like, I have to go to the grocery store, but I can't smoke unless I go to the grocery store. And so I have to smoke, but something that should have taken 15 minutes is going to take 2 hours because yeah. I'm smoking in a grocery store, you know? And it's this thing where it's like your body acclimates to it and you have to, quote unquote, smoke to feel normal. When in reality, like, you're just so used to being high all the time that to not be hot, you start feeling withdrawal. Like, there yeah. is a withdrawal, you know? And so I think it's important to talk about, like, actual medicinal use. Like, you're not going into withdrawal when you're not taking it. You know what I mean? Whereas yeah. like, for me, when I was, you know, taking 50 milligrams of THC to feel something, you know, one day without it, like, I remember yeah. just at my desk being like, I can't write unless I'm stoned, but I know if I get stoned, I won't write. And being stoned in the bathtub at 11 a.m., having not written, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm at this point, and part of the reason I love Artist Way is, like, outsourcing my creativity to anything feels dangerous. Mm. And I think specifically with marijuana, so often it's like, well, it makes me creative. And there was actually an amazing podcast with the Huberman Lab. He did a great podcast about marijuana. And there was a study essentially that said, like, people who, like, marijuana can make you more creative, kind of, but it's people who are more creative tend to use marijuana. So it's kind of like the chicken, you know?
And so, that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's like, if you're open to the idea of marijuana, you're probably more creative. And so,
that's
yeah,
probably true with, I wonder if that's true with psychedelics as well. But, I mean, you are quite literally expanding your mind, and people who are creative are looking for mind expansion in many, many forms.
Definitely. And I was too. And I was doing, like, research chemicals from the Netherlands. Like, I was doing weird whack ass, like,
I can't wait for this book.
Yeah.
I wow.
The garbage canned. Like, I did some weird stuff, but it's, I think, and that's, I mean, the same thing with marijuana is happening with the psychedelic, you know, sort of like, this is medicine. And I do think that there are psychedelic experiences that can be spiritual and mind expanding, but also at the same time, like, it is not the penultimate panacea. Like, again, like, mm-hmm. there is so much potential for psychosis in both of those. And when I use that word, I think it's hard to understand what that means. And most specifically, since getting sober, I've seen 4 cases of weed-induced psychosis. Like, just weed-induced psychosis got me sober. And then I saw it 3 more times. And the thing that's kind of scary about weed-induced psychosis is, like, because there isn't a larger conversation about it, when you experience it, you're like, what is going on? And usually it's, you know, sort of hyperfixating on something that's, like, not in the realm of reality. So, like, for example, with my ex, it was, like, the antinatalism stuff. And
I need to look this up. So there's, like,
yeah, I've done so much more.
That
yeah,
you tell me, give me a really quick description of antinatalism, and then we're going to talk about music.
Okay, great. Antinatalism is people who believe that you shouldn't have children and we should walk into extinction hand in hand. And so, his whole thing was like, why do you want to bring children into this world? It's a bad place. I didn't consent to be born. Why would you do that to somebody, basically? And so when he was in psychosis, it was like, you're not listening to me. And then like jumbled of that. And then like, it's a kind of like a feature of like, you're not listening as you're sitting there and being like, I can't follow the thread. Like that has been a
Yeah.
prominent feature of weed-induced psychosis. And so yeah, I just talk about it because I think when I talk to people one-on-one, they're like, oh yeah, my cousin or my brother or whatever. But there isn't a larger conversation about it. So all this is to say, like, too much of anything is bad, is what I'm learning as a recovered person or in recovery. But also, like, it takes what it takes. Like, I had to go to such extremes in order to pop my head out of my ass and be like, I don't want to live like this anymore. Like, I'm not meant to be having a panic attack in an Alabama gas station. And now I'm.
As glamorous as that sounds, unfortunately, I don't think that's what you were meant to do.
No, it was a good wake-up call.
Yeah.
Before we part ways, we always end every episode with the music minute.
Give me.
So I the whole t every time you say TCB, I obviously think of Taking Care of Business by Bachman Turner Overdrive. Like that's been in my head the whole time we've been talking. Lisa, do you have any songs? Otherwise, I want to hear just like a quick minute from Paulina why she's obsessed with
I just
Elvis.
had a quick association while we were talking because she was talking about Elvis and how writing the book saved her life. And then I immediately jumped to Elvis Costello and Every Day I Write the Book.
Oh.
I like that connection there you just did.
Random connection in my head.
That's my new anthem.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's so funny because whenever I talk about TCB, people hear that song in their head. I'm like, but Elvis didn't sing that song,
Yeah.
Forever been my mantra. But for me, so I became obsessed with Elvis when I was 8 years old, and I actually found like a kids bop version of Elvis songs at a Tower Records. And I listened to that so much that my mom was like, that's a guy, right? Like that's like a grown man. I was like, what? And I think this is actually quite interesting. I think I experienced childhood depression, and so sometimes I have a hard time hearing and listening to music. And so I can either hear the beat or the lyrics, and I have to read the lyrics to actually understand them. But with Elvis, it was like the music was always so joyful and light, and the lyrics were simple, and so I could hear it all at once. And so I think as a kid, that was like very nourishing, is like these sort of light, playful songs that I actually could hear. And it wasn't until I did Ecstasy at Bonnaroo that I was like, oh my God, I've been depressed my whole life. Like I can hear music and lyrics at the same time. And so it's so funny, being an 8-year-old obsessed with Elvis and like only 80-year-olds get Elvis. And now that the Elvis movie came out, like Elvis is in vogue.
Yeah.
Like I've been saying this for 20 years, but growing up, my favorite songs were All Shook Up or Stuck on You. Again, like love songs that are playful and fun, but also like there's something so soulful about him. And above all, like I used to pray to Elvis before ice skating competitions, and like
Yes.
it's so wild that like I was praying to like a drug addict performer, and it's like in some weird way, like there was some sort of divine connection between us. So
Dude, Paulina, this is Lisa probably knows what I'm about to say, but like I developed a childhood obsession around 6, 7, 8 with Jim Morrison.
damn.
And he has been my North Star literally my whole life. Like, I moved to New York because of Jim Morrison. I spent 3 days at his grave in Paris writing poetry. I mean, like,
Hardcore.
we can talk about our childhood obsessions with these adult drug addict men.
Yeah,
Maybe we should write something about
I
that
was about
together,
to say.
honestly.
I think so. Like I feel like that, like there's like a collection in this or something, some sort of essay series. A week from today, I'm going to be at Graceland.
Okay, great.
Oh, my
Oh, wow.
second
Like
time there.
Spinal Tap.
Yeah, did they go to Graceland and Spinal Tap?
Yes, we just watched that scene. Yes.
Oh my God, amazing! Yeah, I went when I after that Bonnaroo where I did Ecstasy, I went to Graceland and cried at his grave.
That was, I mean, I was drinking, smoking cigarettes, and writing poetry at Jim Morrison's grave. My hair was hot pink.
Oh.
And you know, but I had this epiphany of like, if I could spend 3 days in Paris alone, if I could figure out Parisian public transportation alone, I could move to New York, you
That's
know? So like,
cool.
I would not have moved here without him, you know? And it's so weird to have this like 27-year-old drug addict as my North Star, but it is what
Yeah.
it is.
Throughout my childhood, people loved to taunt me and be like, he died on the toilet eating donuts. And I was like, you don't know. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jim Morrison died in a bathtub. So there's a lot we need to
Well,
talk about, Paulina.
yeah. I love this collaborative essay. Love it.
So Paulina, please just remind people how they can find your work. And thank you so much for this. This was beautiful.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry I went a little long with my it's just so con it's just it's all tied together. And anyways, you can find me. My website is paulinapinsky.com. I offer courses in independent writing coaching. We're going to do a year-long artist way starting the 21st and 22nd. I'm also starting a course called Start Your Own Substack, which is going to start February 7th. Tawny, I would love to have you come speak to my students.
Yeah.
You can find me on Instagram at Paulina_Pinsky. I think Twitter is Paulina_Pinsky_. I need to fix that. For a
You just need
long
to get off Twitter
time.
anyway.
I
Like,
know. Is
life is
that
better off Twitter.
Yeah, I do. So just Instagram. I don't even like really go on Twitter. I just like feel like I've been there for so long. I like have a hard time.
Yeah.
Bye. So yeah. Instagram, Paulina_Pinsky, my website, you can always find me there. And I love helping people discover how to tell their story. So if you're someone who wants to write but doesn't know where to start, I'm your gal. So, and Newly Sober is my Substack, and I would love to have you there.
Well, we're going to link to all of that in the show notes. So if you're listening, don't worry about rewinding and writing all that down. Paulina, thank you for hanging out with us today, and we
Thank you.
will see you another time.
Thank you so much for having me. I treasure you both so much.
Thanks,
Thank you for having
Paulina. That was awesome.
Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. If so, please hit subscribe and consider rating and reviewing us so others can find us. Tawny, how can our listeners find you?
You can find me at Tawny M. Lara on all of the social medias. You can find my blog, Sobriety Party, sobrietyeaparty.com. Lisa, how can we find you and your amazing book?
My book is Girl Walks Out of a Bar, and it is available at bookstores everywhere and online. And you can find me at lisasmithadvisory with an O.com. And I'm on social media at Girl Walks Out. Thanks for listening.